Now recording, and I will mute all, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. So welcome all, and glad we already have 27 participants here tonight, so that's great. And just a reminder that guests are welcome. We do have new word that if anybody who is not a member, if you join by March 31st, you will actually get 2 years worth, because the board has decided to extend all memberships that are current as of March 31st by an additional year. So that includes new people just joining us. So if you join now, rather than 1 year for $20, you'll get 2 years for $20. We are recording. This will go up with the deck to our website after the session tonight. And if anybody has additional comments, questions, anything else, feel free to break in. You can enter information into the chat window. And I will now kick it over to Alan to start us off for the night with the deck. And Alan, you have to unmute yourself. There we go.
Thanks, Chris. I'm just glad to what you were saying. That extension in membership also means that anybody who is currently a member, you do not need to renew. So please don't send us a check. We like checks, but you don't really need to send us one. Okay, tonight we have a few different things. Tom mentioned that Microsoft has come to a settlement in a class action lawsuit. So it basically means if you bought Microsoft Windows or Windows Office or any component of Office like Excel or Word, within a certain time frame between 1998 and 2010, you can basically sign up for this class action lawsuit, and you get a few tens of dollars here and there, depending on how many things you purchased. And it's all over the internet. If you search for Microsoft class action, you'll find it, or use this link right here. We'll get you to the one that Tom was mentioning.
And receipts are not necessary.
Up to a certain value.
Until you get to about $250, I think.
Yeah, after that,
most people, receipts are not necessary.
Yeah.
Okay, and the next thing we have is another suggestion from Thomas, a system he's been using, so I'll let him talk about it, RTX Voice.
Okay, can I share my screen?
Absolutely.
Sure, just a second. I'll make you a co-host. And yes. Okay, so you should be able to do a share now.
Okay, and I guess I want this one. Okay, so here's my system. This is an NVIDIA RTX Voice. There's a bunch of it's useful in a lot of different things because it basically sets itself up as a filter or another driver. So, for example, if I go here to the RTX Voice icon and open this, I said open this. Okay, there we are. And move that in. And you can see that it uses AI, artificial intelligence, to remove background noise from the audio. And right now the input device is my default device, which is my headphones currently, and the output device is my headphones. So right now, and that's in general a good place to leave it. And if I go to the sound settings here and open the sound settings, and you can see it's set to my headphone. Now, if I go to Zoom, where is Zoom? In here, you can specify in the audio what is the thing here. Now, I have a radio.
Right.
So I have a radio, and I'll now turn my microphone from the headset microphone. Now, as you probably hear, because I can't hear it, the music is all eliminated and there's only voice, either the words from the song or my own. So it does a really good job of eliminating excess noise.
That's incredibly effective.
It is. It's absolutely amazing. And I'm still using the RTX voice. You can use it on the speaker as well. If you have a problem with somebody else's audio, it gets rid of anything that sort of it does not recognize as voice. So that's a good. It can be a very good thing to have if you're in a noisy environment. On the other hand, if there are people around you talking, of course, it won't work. So let's get back to my. So that's how RTX voice works. There is, if I go back to this, there is a particular PCGamer.com that shows you how to work it. It works on most NVIDIA graphics cards. I have a mobile 1650. But it's good for mechanical keyboards. It's good for almost anything. You can also you can choose how much to eliminate. So if things aren't working out right for you, or you can ask people who are listening, you can reduce this amount by dragging it.
That's amazing. I have a RTX 2070, so that should be able to handle it, no problem at all.
Well, I only have a 1650, which is kind of entry level.
Yeah.
So that's RTX voice. And if you have, there's no other thing I wanted to show. So if you have any kind of NVIDIA graphics card, and I think some of the latest AMD CPUs, the Zen series, I think some of them have a GeForce GPU inside of them, and I'm not sure if it works on them, but if you have a recent AMD CPU, you might want to try it on there as well. The other thing I wanted to mention, which I might as well do while I'm talking here, is this thing that came on here. This is Hard Disk Sentinel, which is pointed to my SSD. And there is a problem with SSDs in that if the information is not refreshed very often, you get fast and slow regions of the SSD. And if you want your SSD to be full speed, by the way, the things at the very top are probably empty things that don't actually have anything there. But the things that are in the middle, like that, if you reset your SSD sort of by reflashing it either with HD Sentinel, which is a program here that I'm using. It's a pay program, but you can actually have it refresh every sector on the disk, which is a little wasteful considering you're refreshing stuff that there may be nothing there. But you can use a program my Defrag. Which will actually, you can choose to defragment, sort of, by copying stuff that hasn't been accessed in a while to another portion of your SSD. This is one thing I would suggest if people wish to keep their SSD running fast. There is I'll put the link. There is a program this has been discovered fairly recently. And where is it? Read speed. This is from, I don't know how people are familiar with Gibson Research Corporation. They do SpinRite. But they, this guy has been, did a program called Read Speed. It's a bootable program that runs on DOS, actually, on FreeDOS, that will actually measure how fast your hard drive or your SSD is. And if you look at this particular, and I'll send, put a send a link there. There's a video showing showing how it what they've discovered. Basically, this guy writes in assembler language, and he's the guy who behind Security Now on the Twit network. And he's found that SSDs are really, they slow down if they haven't been rewritten in a while. On the other hand, if you rewrite everything, then obviously you use up lives of the SSD. So what I do is I use my defrag to to copy the stuff that's over 60 days old onto a different portion of the SSD. And it's, of course, it's a defragger, a very, what do I want to say? A very conformable, customizable defragger that I recommend highly for hard disks. And it's also useful for SSDs if you want to look into it. So that's my contribution for this meeting.
Thanks, Tom. We had a question from B. This is going back to the RTX sound. Is there something that is the opposite? They need to be able to hear the music in the fitness classes. And there is a setting in Zoom called Enable Original Sound in the mic settings, but it does not work on tablets.
I obviously this could work the other way, but I don't think that they've put that capability in.
Yeah.
I'd suggest, karaoke things if you can find them.
Okay. Okay, thanks very much, Tom. And if we have any questions, no, nothing so far. So we'll go back to the main deck. All right.
Okay, so the next thing is a follow-up on a question from last week for Chris.
Yeah, so this was last week. Joss had a problem with Java not updating in that the pop-up would come up saying, click here to update Java, and he'd click there and nothing would happen. And so I suggested he manually go to java.com and update there. However, he found another way that worked. And he just went and typed in Java in the taskbar search box. And one of the things that popped up was the control panel applet. And if you go into that, there is an option in there to say check for updates. And that actually did work to do the update for him. So either way, if you're having a problem with Java updates, either going to java.com and just say, install it, or go to the Java control panel applet, should actually work as well. And Joss says he will keep us informed as to whether pop-ups in the future actually work or not. Now, there is a question, though, is do you need Java? A lot of people have Java on their computer, and I think most people probably don't actually need it. Now, Joss actually does need it. He has a program that he likes to run that does require Java. But what I recommend people do is just go ahead and uninstall it. So go into Settings, Apps, look for Java, look for J2SE, Java 2, Java 2SE, Java Runtime Environment. Depending on how old the version of Java is, it'll be named different things. And just remove it. And if you don't ever need it again, you've just removed a potential vulnerability on your computer by reducing the attack surface on your computer. If you ever do need it, it'll come up and say, I need Java to run, and then go to java.com and install it. But I would be willing to bet that most people will never get prompted to install Java, and they put out a lot of security updates every year. And so it's worth getting rid of it if you don't need it on your computer. And there is an article I've written on reducing the attack surface that talks about this idea, and that will be coming to the newsletter at some point in the not too distant future, I guess.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Tom, there is a question in the chat here. Let's just move up the queue here. Glenn wants to know if HD Sentinel uses up some of the life of the SSD when it refreshes.
I expect that if you did a complete refresh, as far as I know, HD Sentinel it does a dumb refresh. It reads every sector and then it rewrites it with the stuff that it read. So that will use up the life of the SSD. It especially matters now that we're using what do they call it? Multiple level cells, MLC, versus single level cells. So a consumer style SSD will use up its life. And life is something like, I think up to about 10,000 rewrites. Which is not bad. The single level cells apparently have like 100,000, but multiple level cells are a lot cheaper and they run, but apparently the problem is that they have to do some processing to actually do error correction and so on. So it takes some time to actually read the stuff that is older and not fresh. I'm taking 60 days as my time period for refreshing, and my defrag allows me to choose all files that are for 60 days haven't been written in 60 days to actually rewrite them in another sector of the SSD, so that refreshes them for me.
And Lawrence has a comment on Java. He says, from a professional perspective, they stopped using Java applet, firstly because it's no longer free for commercial use, and secondly because fewer programs use it. Okay, so the next thing we have is another follow-up on the question that came up last week about WhatsApp. And Chris had this one from Bruce Schneider.
I got to remind myself what it was I actually had there. So Bruce Schneier actually in his latest cryptogram, he did have an article specifically on WhatsApp and the change in the user agreement. And he said, be careful what the changes are that you're going to be forced to agree to if you want to keep using the app. And basically in 2016, WhatsApp gave users a one-time ability to opt out about having all of this account data turned over to Facebook. I'd be willing to bet most people didn't opt out. And now the policy is changing so that you no longer have that choice if you want to continue to use WhatsApp. Now, okay. Some of the data that is being collected and potentially handed off to the mothership is phone numbers stored in address books, profile names, profile pictures, so forth, what you see on the screen there. Now, apparently, the WhatsApp has delayed this because of all of the kerfuffle that was raised about it. So it has been delayed somewhat, but you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that eventually it's going to occur. So question is, you know, first off, my thought is if you're using a commercial or a program that is put out by a company whose main aim is to make money and you're getting something for free, you know, maybe you're the product. And so it's not really surprising that they may be wanting to try to monetize your existence on their platform. And maybe Signal is looking better at this point in time.
And PC Magazine had an article too, talking about the same thing, this idea of WhatsApp data ending up with Facebook. And they suggested some alternatives, which included Signal and a couple of other free ones, plus this commercial one. But just note in the middle here, they say if you're getting rid of WhatsApp, make sure you delete your WhatsApp account and then delete the app from your phone. So I guess that somehow that gets rid of all the transfer functions.
Now, Bob Walker here. I just want to note that Signal was down for a little bit because so many people dumped WhatsApp in favor of Signal. They got completely overloaded and had a bit an issue. And Chris has mentioned WhatsApp has put off this change in privacy policy for 3 months. And they may or may not continue with the change, but the pushback has been so big for them that they may decide to abandon the change in policy just to keep some business.
It's interesting too, Bob, that policy doesn't apply to Europe. They have much more stringent requirements than we do in North America. And those people that moved over, it was huge. It was something like Signal went from like 20 million subscribers to I think 50 million subscribers.
Wow.
No wonder they ran out of servers.
Well, maybe I can use a VPN to look like I'm using WhatsApp from Europe and avoid the privacy policy.
Okay. We talked last time about the Google Groups and the announcements list. And so I'm going to carry on with this series, and today I want to talk about the newsletter. So our Google Group's called OPC UG Newsletter. It's again a Google Groups listserver, so Bridget is our editor. She edits, creates the monthly newsletter, and then she sends an email message to the listserver. And typically she'll attach the PDF file to that message. A couple of times recently we've had problems where the files got huge and Bridget's only been able to send a link, but I think that's been resolved now. So in future it should be a message with the actual newsletter attached as a PDF file. So Bridget sends one message to the server and the list server relays it to everybody who subscribed. And this is another one of these free groups. Anybody can subscribe to our newsletter and receive the newsletter by email. And you don't necessarily have to be a member, but you do have to subscribe to the Google group. Typically then what happens is once a month, and this will be good timing tonight, because if you subscribe tonight, you'll probably get the newsletter within the next week, because it usually comes out sometime just after the weekend, on or after the weekend. So you'll get this kind of email message, and the circle here is the attached PDF file from the September newsletter. Clearly, there are other ways you can obtain the newsletter. You could actually go to Google Groups on the web and browse through the newsletter group and pull up the individual newsletters from the messages that were posted there. Or alternatively, if you go to the club's website, right in the middle of the homepage, you'll find the latest newsletter link. And if you click on that, it will basically take you to, it will basically download the current PDF file. And then finally, any of the past issues you can get from the website by going to opcug.ca/newsletters. And they're all organized there by year and then by month of issue. So all of our newsletters are available one way or the other. But clearly the easiest way to do it is to subscribe to the newsletter Google's group, and it will end up in your inbox automatically. Okay, moving along. Stuart sent us a share. He was looking to find out when he could get his COVID-19 injection. Came across this article with a link to a thing called OmniCalculator. He says it's a collection of calculators for all kinds of oddball things. And there must be a lot of oddball things, because it says there your life in 1,566 free calculators. I can't imagine what the other 1,565 calculators are. Anyway, if you need a calculator to do anything, I'm sure if you go to that link, you should be able to find it. Okay, so you'll recall that I'd asked for people to send ideas for apps on Android phones and tablets that you find useful or entertaining or whatever. And I said it could also be a program for your computer. So tonight, I want to share with you such a program for your computer. And the program is VirtualBox. And VirtualBox, as it suggests, is a way to run virtual machines on your regular computer. So typically, you use this so you can run other operating systems. So you might want to run Linux on your Windows desktop system, for example. Or I might want to run Windows on my Linux desktop system. Or both of us might want to run DOS on either Windows or Linux. And then you say, well, why on earth would I want to run DOS? Well, there are actually some good reasons why you might want to run DOS, but typically you're running Linux or Windows. And Chris and I have just been looking at a new installation of Windows, and it turned out it was convenient to run Windows as a virtual machine and then install Windows that way, so we could kind of see what was happening without affecting our actual installation of Windows 10. So it's a very convenient way of checking things out, if you like. Really easy to, it's basically just a program. So you download and install VirtualBox, and the current version is 6.1.18. And if you go to the virtualbox.org website, you'll find links to download it. However, there's another thing you want to do, and that's you probably want to download and install the extension pack, because the extension pack gives you USB support. So if you only install VirtualBox, it's basically trying to run things off regular hard drives or an optical disk like a CD or a DVD. If, like me, you have a laptop that doesn't have a DVD anymore, then you really need to be able to access a USB flash drive plugged into one of the ports. And the only way you can do that in VirtualBox is to have the extension pack. So if you go to the main screen, you will download the VirtualBox software from this group of links right here. And then further down, you need to pick up this VirtualBox extension pack. So once you've got those two pieces of software, then you install VirtualBox just like a regular Windows program. And when you run it, you end up with a screen something like this. And to install the extension pack, you basically pick up this preferences icon and select that. And it will drop down a window, and then over here on the plus sign, if you hit the plus sign, then it will let you browse for the extension pack that you just downloaded. So you find the extension pack and then basically tell it to install. So now you've installed both VirtualBox, the software, and the extension pack, which gives us access to USB drives, amongst other things, but that's the main thing. Right, so now we're running the program. So what we want to do now is click on this new icon on the control panel here. And that's basically to set up a new virtual machine. So once we select that button, then we get a drop down. And in the name of the machine in the middle there, we can type Windows 10. And once you type Windows 10, VirtualBox is smart enough to know that you want to install some kind of Windows. And so it fills in the rest of the things for you, and you don't really need to worry about it. and you can just hit next. And now VirtualBox takes you through a series of screens, dialog boxes, and it wants to know how much memory you want to allocate and what kind of a virtual hard drive you want to have and how big that hard drive is going to be and all kinds of hard questions like that. The easy way to deal with all those questions is just to click next, just select the default. So for example, for the amount of RAM it wants, it's suggesting 2 gigabytes. So I basically just say, fine, 2 gigabytes is probably good. I'll just select next. Now it wants to know what kind of a hard drive I want, and it's suggesting to create a VHD, a virtual hard disk. That's fine. And then it wants to know what kind of hard disk, and I want to have a virtual box disk image. These are all defaults, right? The radio buttons are defaults. So I just keep clicking next to go to the next one. Then the next one is dynamically allocated space. And then finally, it wants to know how big, and it's suggesting 50 gigabytes, which sounds reasonable. And the final step is, instead of saying next, you say create. And now we're going to create the virtual machine based on the amount of RAM and the type of hard drive and the size of hard drive that we've suggested. So now we set up our Windows virtual machine, and it's got all these various properties. And now we can click on start. Now the problem is, of course, we actually haven't installed Windows. So the first thing that's going to happen is it's going to want us to install Windows. And here's the trick. This is really why I wanted to show you this thing. Because when it starts off, it's really looking for an optical disk. It thinks we've got a CD. And as I said, I don't have a CD, so I can't just point to my CD drive and say, there's the Windows installation disk. But if you notice down here, there's this little folder with an arrow. If I click on that guy, it will basically let me add a source for this Windows installation. So I select add, and then I can choose my external USB flash drive, which is drive E, and you can see that contains an ISO file, which I downloaded from Microsoft. So this is my Windows installation file as an ISO disk file. And so now I've added that in as a possibility. I can now choose that ISO file as my installation medium. And now it's selected the ISO file, so we can say start. And now you probably recognize that we're running a Windows installation disk. And basically that ISO file is a virtual disk, if you like. So now it wants to know what language we want. We want English and the US and all that kind of good stuff. And so off we go, and we're into install now. So basically, now we just follow all the prompts as you would normally do with a Windows installation. And eventually, at the end of the road, you will actually be running Windows 10. So here, you have Windows 10 running in the blue VirtualBox window on a Windows 10 desktop, which is the light blue background. So my Windows 10 in the center here is running on a virtual Windows machine. So now I can do things like I can take screenshots of the installation. I can see how all the prompts work. I can try different things, and I haven't actually done anything to my real Windows 10 installation. So it's a really good way to test things out. Okay. So I don't see anybody question that.
One thing I can comment on, if you want, Alan, is when you did all those defaults, a lot of them can be adjusted later on, like the amount of RAM that you allocate to the virtual machine. You can go back afterwards. So if you choose inappropriate numbers, you can adjust them later on.
Yeah, and it's also easy just to delete the machine and start over with a brand new machine. So
yeah,
you haven't really lost anything if you don't quite get it right the first time.
Like Bob Walker here. Is there an Android emulator that can run in this thing so I can run Android apps?
There is an Android emulator for Windows. I don't know whether it is an Android and a version of Android that you can load in VirtualBox. Good question. I don't know.
What do people use the VirtualBox for? If there are any users on here, do you use it for Windows or Unix or Linux? Or what do people use it for? What applications do they have? Do you have?
Well, the application in this case was to run the Windows installation to see exactly what the current set of prompts were without having to trash a real machine.
Yeah, this was in the aim of the article that Alan and I are writing on setting up a new computer. I have used it in the past just to install dodgy applications or things that I'm really not sure of and install it there to see what it does to the computer before I trust it on my main computer.
Yeah, you can use it kind of as a sandbox like that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I actually don't bother running Linux in a virtual machine because it's easy for me to dual boot, and so I can have Windows in one partition and Linux in the other partition. So there's nothing to be gained, I don't think, by running a VM with one or the other.
Well, I suppose you'd be able to paste stuff back and forth if that was one of your desires.
Well, my data drive is a third partition, so it's shared between the two anyway, so it doesn't matter.
We have one question on, can we save the VM image to disk and load it at startup instead of reinstalling each time? Yes, you can. I think probably the default is that it writes to the virtual hard drive its current state when you do a shutdown. But you can also, I'm not 100% sure that VirtualBox has this, but other virtual machines, I have seen it. You can have it where it doesn't write to the virtual hard drive, so it doesn't make any changes when you shut down, if you want that. But you can definitely have it where it writes its current state when it shuts down, so that when you start it up the next time, you're picking up exactly where you left off.
Yeah, that's true, Chris. When you shut down, you have the option to either power down or save the system state.
Right.
Okay, so the smile for the day is my mind is like my internet browser.
Didn't God tell Moses, take two tablets and call me in the morning?
Good one.
Something like that. Okay, that's everything we have that's prepared, and it's only 8:10, so we've got lots of time. If anybody has any other questions or comments or things they would like to share.
I'm going to put B on the spot. We've been exchanging some emails about some issues on her computer. And B, would you like to chime in on the current state of your computer? You'll have to unmute yourself if you want to. Maybe B doesn't want to talk about the current state of your computer.
Oh, sorry. yes. Okay, I will show myself too. I'm in my basement quarantining from my recent expedition. Yes, it is. Seems okay. I ran the full scan, and there were no problems except for some that were password protected, but I could identify all but three of those as things that I knew had a password and weren't a problem. And then I did a disk copy, so I have a brand new backup. And the four little things that were wanted to run as hazards, sorry, not hazards, that's the wrong word, but you know what I mean. They decided to run themselves and installed with no problem. I haven't had the time or the nerve to try the full Windows update, but I will.
Okay. Just as a history on this for anybody on the call who isn't aware of it. So B had a problem in that she was browsing around and all of a sudden got a pop-up saying saying that the computer was locked and to call a certain number and not to close down the window or close down the computer, and looked very suspicious. So she didn't call the number. Kudos for you on that. And then had some problems with updates that from Microsoft that were not installing correctly, and also had a problem with Bitdefender saying that there was a security setting that was had been changed on her, and did she want to reset it and so forth. So it sounds like everything is sorting itself out. The last thing that B alluded to about not being brave enough yet for was she's also getting the prompt to update to Windows 2009, I guess, the fall update.
Yeah.
And so that actually is not a huge update. So if you were on 2004, like you are right now, if you're on 2004, going to 2009 is actually a minor update.
Okay.
So yeah, I haven't heard of anybody having problems going from 2004 to 2009. Okay. Now, if you're on something older than 2004, 2009 will be a major update, and it will take a number of hours probably to complete.
Okay.
Going from 2004 to 2009, it'll probably be like, you know, 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. It just sounded so major.
Well, it is a feature update, so Microsoft comes out with those twice a year.
Right.
And so it is a feature update, but they're currently on a cadence where every other one, like the spring updates are major, and uh-huh. they take typically, you know, an hour to 4 or 5 hours. And then the fall updates are actually minor updates, and they go in quite quickly.
Okay, awesome.
That's the current cadence.
The scan took 12 hours.
Yeah, that's not surprising. Full scans on computers for malware, it basically has to open up every file on your computer and examine it, and that can take time. You know, most people have tens of thousands of files on their computer that then have to be examined.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your help. I was in an absolute panic, but I'm glad that at least I'd listened to you guys enough to know not to call the number and not
Very
to
good.
Believe it. It had like perfect Windows, Microsoft insignia and everything.
Yeah, they're good at stealing logos.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like
logos
that.
Are easy to steal, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Good to hear, B.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Do we have anybody else?
Wendy had a question. Can you recommend a good program for cleaning the registry? Tom says it may not be necessary. Windows does an okay job. Other choices might be CC Cleaner or Wise Registry Cleaner. And Chris probably has some comments too.
Oh, I definitely have comments on that. Don't use a registry cleaner, period. Let me just see if I can find my deck where I have the information about this. Because
if you want, I can tell my ditty while you look up your deck.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so my share is that I had purchased on behalf of my organization a web server with the service, Web Hosting Canada, providing a remote backup. In addition to that backup, I also have an additional backup that backups not only the websites that we have on this server, but it backs up the whole operating system and so forth. And I have that running once a week. Good balance. Every week I'm on there and I'm checking the files, and I'm actually backing up those files off the web server onto our on-site premises. So I literally am giving myself three backups. I have emails that tell me every day when the backup runs and so forth, and it tells me how long it takes and how much, and all that was great. So today, our web developer said, I need to restore a website. Can we do this? I said, yes, we can.
Coming.
And when I went on to the application, there I see that the backup that it has listed as the last backup running is from October 18th. Houston, we have a problem. I haven't heard back from Web Hosting Canada. I suspect that what's happening is that there was a disconnection between my web server and the remote backup server that no one ever bothered to see. And I'm waiting to hear the end result. I do know I have the physical backups, but the program itself is showing that it hasn't backed up since October the 18th. So wow. The lesson to share is that, yes, you can actually look at the files. Yes, you can get the email alerts that tell you that everything's functioning okay, but nothing is better than actually going into the program and checking to see that, yes, it does have access to the most recent backup. That's my share.
Yeah, that's a good one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I can't seem to find the deck that I had this in that was about the registry cleaners. But Microsoft doesn't support the use of registry cleaners. And anybody who – I'll do a follow-up slide next week for sure on this because there are links to their official statements mm-hmm. on registry cleaners. Some of the most brilliant people that I've ever heard of at Microsoft, such as Mark Rusinovich, absolutely abhors registry cleaners. And if they say more often than not, registry cleaner will cause problems than solve problems. And so it's highly, highly recommended that you do not use a registry cleaner on your computer at all. Now, if you run a registry cleaner, they will come up and say, oh, there's all kinds of things here that are wrong pointers and, you know, invalid data. Don't worry about it. The registry definitely will leave things lying around in it, but they're of no consequence. You know, it'll be pointers to things that just, it will never get called, you know, that sort of stuff. It may sit in the registry. It's not going to be a problem. So any registry cleaner that tells you that you've got issues that need solving, don't believe it. And I will do a follow-up. I'll make a note for myself right now. I'll do a follow-up next week on that.
Chris, if I could add why I asked the question.
Yep.
Okay, so what happened was I'm here in the United States. I'm a friend of Natalie's. And I have an investing program called Fidelity from Fidelity.com. And the web page was not opening some of the different functions in it. It was like a spinning JavaScript, if you think of the little spinning circles.
Okay.
And so I went on to Fidelity's tech support. They checked out, you know, the program, and they said, well, it's running okay on our machine. So I have two laptops. I went into my other laptop. It worked fine in Chrome on a second computer. It worked fine on the machine I was having the problems with in Internet Explorer, but this website would not work on Chrome on the one machine.
Okay.
So when I was talking to you know, I uninstalled Chrome. I started all over again. I mean, I, you know, rebooted the computer. I did all kinds of crap. Next day, still not working. So they felt that there was something in the registry that regarding Chrome that was still stuck. And I since ended up getting my computer. I have Geek Squad through Best Buy where I bought it, and they actually cleaned up the registry. And once they cleaned out just the registry related to Chrome after complete uninstall, when we reinstalled, it finally worked. Because we were uninstalling, they were uninstalling Chrome several times, and it still wouldn't work.
Yeah, okay. The first thought that I usually have when a website or something isn't working is to do things like, empty the cache, some stuff like that, which is always very safe to do.
Now, we cleared cache, cookies, everything. We took we even went to an incognito browser where nothing would be working, like, extensions. We turned all extensions off. None of that worked.
Yeah. Now, definitely, I mean, if there is something wrong in the registry, it can definitely cause problems, but the likelihood is really, really low. And the idea is that a registry cleaner will try to do a whole bunch of stuff that is questionable at worst and at best is innocuous. Now, in your case, it sounds like you did have something in the registry that was causing problems, but the likelihood of that happening is really, really low. And, a registry cleaner, usually you don't have the ability to so much direct it to only, well, actually, I guess you do in most registry cleaners. It'll come up with a list of what it's going to correct for you. And if you just restrict it to things that seem to be related to Chrome, then it's probably going to be safer than just running it on everything. But you're the first person I've heard that actually had a registry problem that got fixed by a registry cleaner. So it's I guess buyer beware on something like that, and your mileage may vary.
Excuse me. One, did the person actually use a registry cleaner, or did he just wipe out the Chrome registry entries?
No, Best Buy actually had some kind of their own proprietary registry cleaner. And as Chris mentioned, when they ran it, they specifically looked for only Chrome-related and just got rid of those items that were related. Because Chrome at that point was totally uninstalled from my computer. So anything that was still hanging around from the old Chrome, they just got rid of that. Then when we did the reinstall, the program came up beautifully right away.
They might just have used RegEdit to get rid of all the Chrome registry entries.
I had looked at that, Tom, to do RegEdit, but I didn't feel comfortable doing it on my own at that point. So that's why I called them, since I pay for their service too.
Yeah.
But they actually had, because I was watching them. They were on my desktop remotely. So I was watching the program that they have their own little, their little proprietary, but it was a registry thing because it had something registry, on the top of it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you did manage to get it fixed, but as I say, you're the first person I've ever heard of.
at least I know not to purchase anything, to invest in a cleaner to do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't, because it's not something you should be doing on an ongoing basis for sure. So
Chris has to change his deck now to say almost always.
Exactly. Thanks very much for the input there, Wendy.
Yeah, just a note, the same note for not using registry cleaners normally applies to some of these driver updater programs as well. Microsoft Update does a very good job of keeping your drivers up to date. And these driver updaters will always find problems, and they'll grab all sorts of drivers from unknown sources that can cause a lot more damage than they'll ever fix.
Yeah, the one driver that I tend to go for, which is not necessarily going to be up to date at Windows Update, is video drivers. And so I will go to NVIDIA and grab their, their latest driver for video. I usually try not to catch one on the day it's been released. But if it's been out for at least a week or two, I'll go ahead and get it there. It seems like for it to be the Windows hardware compliant or whatever it is, that it'll get pushed out by Windows Update. It hits old drivers from a video driver perspective, They are not new drivers, that's for sure. And video drivers can definitely really affect the performance of your computer. So that's the one that I'll grab. Most other drivers, I agree with you, Bob. It's just, you know, they don't need to be updated typically.
I think
I tried a driver updater for a while, and it just screws things up incredibly. I ended up having to re-image the computer to get rid of all the crap.
I think there's a difference, Chris, in going to the manufacturer of your graphics card and downloading a driver from them, as opposed to going on the internet, finding a screwy driver updater program, running that, and seeing what it finds.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There's a great question here from Glenn. Is Wine compatibility layer for running Windows applications on Linux computers legal to use for a user who does not have a Windows license? It's a good one. What you have to realize is Wine, for a start. It's one of these Unix acronym thingamajigs. You know, these programmers, they love this stuff. Wine is not an emulator. So it doesn't emulate Windows. What they've done is they've reverse engineered what Windows does and how it works. And then they've written a bunch of application program interface modules, APIs, that essentially simulate Windows as best they can. I mean, clearly they don't know exactly what Windows does because it's proprietary and Microsoft don't give out the code. So it's a system which is a kind of a ad hoc best approach to make things run as many as best as they can. So really that means that you're not running Windows. There's nothing, it's really got nothing to do with Windows. It just, it looks a bit like Windows, but it's nothing to do with Windows and the code and Microsoft. So you can certainly run Wine on a Linux computer and run Windows applications that you own. I guess you really should have should you have the licenses for the Microsoft apps that you're running? I guess you should. Anyway, you certainly don't need a Windows license to run Wine.
Lawrence pointed out that when we were talking about upgrading to the latest version of Windows, the latest version is actually called 20H2, and yes, you are correct on that. Thank you for that. If it's 20H2 that you're being offered, if you're coming from 2003, is it?
2004.
2004?
She has 1909.
I seem to have 1909, but I may not be looking for it in the right place. That was the last update that it did.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. If you're on 1909, it'll actually be a major update to go to 20H2. Okay. So plan on not needing your computer for 4 hours or more, because it can take that long. It can take longer than 4 hours. It's weird.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
A quick question on that. If your computer is stuck at 1909, because Windows automatic update doesn't want to take it past that for whatever reason, is it still getting the necessary security updates?
It seems to, because it did some security updates and it says those are up to date if you go into the update part.
Yeah. But that's
says the updates are up to date.
Yeah. So whatever version you are on, it has got the security updates, you know, for that version. So you're fine. You don't have a security vulnerability.
Yeah. The reason I asked that question is out of 5 computers you're running here, 4 of them are sitting happily at 2004. None have updated to any later versions yet. But the one that's still sitting at 1909 and won't automatically update past that is, of course, a Microsoft Surface computer. Whereas all the other brands Windows Update seems to move them along just fine.
Okay. Mine's an Acer, so it's a fairly old one.
Yeah, there seems to be no rhyme or reason to some of the blocks that are put in place that people are not getting the absolutely latest version of Windows offered to them. I personally don't really worry an awful lot about it. When they get around to offering it to me, that's fine. They currently, I think they're still on a cadence of, but they're supporting, you know, older version going back a couple of years before you have to update to get security updates and so forth. So.
And if you go to Windows and Settings and look at System, it will tell you what version of Windows you're running.
Yeah, or as Tom pointed out, Windows key and R, and then type in Winver, W-I-N-V-E-R. That'll actually get you that information as well.
Okay, well, before we close up, we've got the magic witching hour here. A couple of notices. Our next regular meeting, a monthly meeting, is on February the 10th. We've got Dee Reimer coming back from Victoria Pie Makers. He's going to be talking about microcontrollers and the kind of things he uses them for around his house, I guess. So that should be interesting. And our next Q&A session will be next week, January 27th. And as usual, if you have questions or things you want to share, send them along to our suggestion box email address.
One note. In the chat, I've copied the script I used for my defrag to refresh my SSD.
Oh, good. Thanks. So anybody's looking for that, you can either pick it up now before the call ends, or it'll be posted on the website under the Q&A section of the website, probably later tonight. Well, thanks very much for showing up, everybody, and hope you have a good week, and hope to see you back here next week.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. Bye now.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.